tonight. Some old faces too. You're coming into this class in midstream, but I think it's flowing in a way that you can probably get something from the different readings and verses that we're referring to. We've been taking a look at the Igon and started off as an introduction to the study of the Igon, and even, of course, any study of the Igon is an introduction to the study of the Igon as it comes out, because you never do get to the bottom of it. But in the process, we've slowed down until we're examining it much more carefully than we did in the first classes, where we used to take 20, 30 pages at a class. Now we've been savoring it a little more and observing some of the details. And we're nearing the end, I think. We'll have about perhaps three more classes on the Igon, and the course will be finished. But that doesn't mean that those of you who've arrived late shouldn't go back to the beginning and have a read again if you haven't read the Igon lately, or if you haven't studied the Igon. And some of the friends here who've been in the class have copies of an outline, of the subject outline of the Igon in sequential order, and also a list of the major themes and topics can be found in God Passes By, where Shoghi Effendi does a little review of the contents of the Igon. And that serves as a kind of a guide, very effective guide, to when you're reading the Igon, looking for these major themes. And you can even make an index by writing down those subjects that he says are in the Igon, and then as you read the Igon, looking for those subjects and putting the page numbers by them. Gradually, in that way, you'll build up your own guide to such an important book that Shoghi Effendi says is preeminent among all the doctrinal works of Baha'u'llah. There's nothing that describes what the truths are in the Baha'i faith that's higher than the Kitab-i-Igon, the Book of Certitude. And it leads, he tells us, to a sure knowledge, to this knowledge that he calls positive knowledge, a sure knowledge of the relationship of God, the manifestations, and mankind, and progressive revelation, and the station of the Bab, and so many other subjects. Now, what we've been studying, we read this very famous passage a couple of weeks ago about the true seeker. What are the qualifications of the true seeker? And if he attains to these qualifications, these qualities and attributes, what reward he can expect in the sense of a transformation, a personal transformation of his soul, so that he will become endowed with a new eye, a new ear, a new mind, a new spirit, and that with that we'll be able to penetrate the wonders and gifts that are stored up in the words of God, in the verses of God. And we'll be able to distinguish truth from falsehood. And we'll be able to attain the object of his quest. And he said that all the attention then of the soul is centered on the city of God, and he talks about the wonders of the city of God. And then he defines that the city of God is none other than the book of God in every age. That the books that the prophets send are really the means of access after their passing to attain to their presence. Now, this Igon has been addressed originally to the uncle, to one of the uncles of the Bab, not the one that raised him, but another uncle. And after meeting Baha'u'llah in Baghdad, this is after the passing, of course, of the Bab, the martyrdom of the Bab, it's later. Now we're talking about 1862. He's been encouraged by some of the Babis, some of the early believers, on his way to make a pilgrimage to Karbala and to Najaf, to the holy places of Shia Islam, which are in Iraq, what's modern day Iraq, but at that time was the Ottoman Empire. And those holy places are the shrines of the Imams, You know, after Muhammad's passing, he left his family, his book and his family as a heritage unto the people. And we understand from Baha'u'llah, from the Bab, from Baha'u'llah, from Abdul Baha, that the 12 successors, lineal, except for the first, Ali, who was the cousin of Muhammad, but after that, his descendants, in all 11 more, constituting with him a group of 12 Imams, were the rightful successors of Muhammad, the intended inheritors of the mantle of the Prophet, and who were to guide and inspire the community after Muhammad's passing. Well, a number of these were either murdered or passed away in Iraq, in what's modern-day Iraq. So the Shias, who believe in the Imams as sources of guidance after Muhammad, make pilgrimages to their shrines. That's why they go there on pilgrimage, as well as, of course, to Mecca, to Muhammad's resting place. Some of the Imams are buried inside Iran itself. There's a famous Imam that's buried in Mashhad, in the north of Iran. So they have pilgrimages inside and outside. They have left their mark on Shia Islam. Will we be hearing about these particular successors? We've been hearing about them all through our study of the Iran. Now, Baha'u'llah has, after that section, began presenting certain arguments to the, or certain points, proofs, for the uncle of the Bab, related to the importance of confirming whether a new message is true or not by the verses of God. In other words, the content of the Quran. It was among the questions of the uncle of the Bab that he presented to Baha'u'llah, that Baha'u'llah permitted him to present, and which Baha'u'llah addresses and answers in this book, the Iqan, are some hadiths. Hadiths are traditional sayings of Muhammad and of the Imams that were recorded down, or that were heard and then were described. So-and-so said, I heard Ali say, and then they say the verse, whatever they thing they heard him say, and then someone else says, I heard so-and-so say that they heard so-and-so say that so-and-so heard Ali say such-and-such. It's a chain of transmission, so that there's some authority going back, who was the person that repeated this to who. So it's like a 5 or 6 time repeated pilgrim note. You know, you can imagine how interesting it gets by the 5th or 6th time. Now, this was happening in Islam for decades and centuries, and then these things were compiled. And when they were compiled, they, lo and behold, there were a lot of them that said, you'd read one and then you'd read another, and they said just the opposite. They seemed to be contradicting each other completely. So there's always a question of which are the accurate ones, and there was a great study in Islam to try to know what were the sounder, as they would. They had a whole series of categories. This was a hadith that was rather spurious. This was a very sound one because it had a good chain. This one, there was a chain, but there was this guy who was a little flaky in the middle there, and you couldn't trust whether really he had repeated it the right way or not. And they have all these endorsements and counter-endorsements of these things. So it becomes very complicated. But in the end, they have volumes and volumes. The Bahar al-Anbar, I think, I don't know, 20 volumes of traditions and on different subjects of sayings besides the Quran. Now, the uncle of the Bab wants all those to be fulfilled by the Bab. Well, Baha'u'llah doesn't want to directly say that's nonsense. He does say it, but he doesn't come at it quite directly like that. He says, look at the Quran. Look what the Quran says. Look at the proofs of the Quran. Look what the verses of the Quran say. This is something so important. And then he says, how can we turn to any other source of guidance but the Quran? So he's telling him, you know, we should... Now, how shall we know what traditions are right or wrong? Fortunately, when the new manifestation comes, he tells you which ones are right. Now, we know that there are a number of these traditions that are correct. Anything that's been cited by Baha'u'llah in the Book of Certitude, we know is correct, because we know Baha'u'llah is a prophet and we believe in him. So we believe that his authority to quote these is he's quoted correct ones. Also the Bab, also the Master. and shall be offended. So now we have a great collection of sayings from Islam that we know are authentic. But we didn't know them until this new day of revelation. And extraordinary things have been fulfilled by the Bab of these prophecies of Muhammad and his successors. And we'll be studying some of those as we move on towards the end of the book. So we're right in the middle of this. Now, in the way of an introduction to the whole subject of how Shias viewed the new day of God and so on, I want to read a short tablet, an extract from a tablet here in the Gleanings. This is on page 69 of the Gleanings. Or if you have the writings of Baha'u'llah, the composite volume, it's section 28. Baha'u'llah says, "Happy is the man who will arise to serve my cause and glorify my beauteous name. Take hold of my book with the power of might and cleave tenaciously to whatsoever commandment thy Lord, the Ordainer, the All-Wise, hath prescribed therein. Behold, O Muhammad, how the sayings and doings of the followers of Shia Islam have dulled the joy and fervor of its early days and tarnished the pristine brilliancy of its light. In its primitive days, whilst they still adhered to the precepts associated with the name of their prophet, the Lord of mankind, their career was marked by an unbroken chain of victories and triumphs. As they gradually strayed from the path of their ideal leader and master, as they turned away from the light of God and corrupted the principle of His divine unity, as they increasingly centered their attention upon them who were only the revealers of the potency of His word, their power was turned into weakness, their glory into shame, their courage into fear. Thou dost witness to what a pass they have come. Behold how they have joined partners with him who is the focal point of divine unity." This was through the exaltation of certain of the Imams to the station of prophethood, and the exaltation of the Prophet and the Imams to the station of Godhead, and so on, depending on the different sects within Shia Islam. "Behold how their evil doings have hindered them from recognizing in the day of resurrection the word of truth, exalted be his glory. We cherish the hope that this people will henceforth shield themselves from vain hopes and idle fancies and will attain to a true understanding of the meaning of divine unity. The person of the manifestation hath ever been the representative and mouthpiece of God. He in truth is the dayspring of God's most excellent titles and the dawning place of his exalted attributes. If any be set up by his side as peers, if they be regarded as identical with his person, how can it then be maintained that the divine being is one and incomparable, that his essence is indivisible and peerless? Meditate on that which we have through the power of truth revealed unto thee, and be thou of them that comprehend its meaning." Now there are a number of other extracts from tablets in this early part of the Gleanings related very closely to the themes of the Iqan. I recommend them to you if you haven't read them recently, to compare them and cross-read them together with these sections of the Iqan that we've been studying. Last week we read that the understanding of the words, to be able to penetrate the meanings and understand the words or verses of God, that certain qualities were necessary. Now, it had been implied that one should be very learned and deepened in all kinds of things to be able to understand the words of God, but Baha'u'llah contradicts that with this saying. He says that the understanding of his words and the comprehension of the utterances of the birds of heaven are in no wise dependent upon human learning. We don't need a doctorate to be able to understand Baha'u'llah's writings or the writings of any of the prophets. In fact, people who've never learned to read and write are perfectly capable of recognizing and being deeply moved by the truths of the revelation, as they have, of course, been for centuries with the other religions of God, because they didn't know how to read and write there either. They heard the verses of God, they would memorize them, would memorize their prayers, and that was the extent. They had to hear someone reciting and talking about the revelation. They depend, he says, solely upon purity of heart, chastity of soul, and freedom of spirit. And then he says, this is evidenced by those who today, though without a single letter of the accepted standards of learning, are occupying the loftiest seats of knowledge. And the garden of their hearts is adorned through the showers of divine grace with the roses of wisdom and the tulips of understanding. Now he returns to his theme again. This is on page 211. If you have the British edition with you, someone know that? Can tell us what page that is? Do you have a cross-section chart? 135, thank you. If you have the British edition, the red, not the small red edition, but the larger one, look on page 135. And likewise he saith, and he quotes now from the Quran, he says, as for those who believe not in the verses of God, or that they shall ever meet him, these of my mercy shall despair, and these doth a grievous chastisement await. Also, and he quotes again from the Quran, and they say, shall we then abandon our gods for a crazed poet? The implications of this verse is manifest. Behold what they observed after the verses were revealed. They called him a poet, scoffed at the verses of God, and exclaimed, saying, these words of his are but tales of the ancients. By this they meant that those words which were spoken by the peoples of old, Muhammad hath compiled and called them the word of God. Likewise in this day, thou hast heard the people impute similar charges to this revelation. Now remember, this book is written in defense of the Babi revelation, not Baha'u'llah's revelation. He's still ostensibly a Babi. He hasn't declared his mission, though he has received his mission in the Siyar Shal. Almost 10 years before the Iqan was revealed, and he lets reflect from these pages his own station a number of times, yet when he refers to this revelation, he's referring to the Bab's revelation still. So he says, likewise in this day thou hast heard the people impute similar charges to this revelation, saying, he hath compiled these words from the words of old, or these words are spurious. Vain and haughty are their sayings, Baha'u'llah says, low their estate and station. After the denials and denunciations which they uttered and under which we have referred, they protested, saying, no independent prophet according to our scripture should arise after Moses and Jesus to abolish the law of divine revelation. Nay, he that is to be made manifest must needs fulfill the law. Thereupon, this verse, indicative of all the divine themes and testifying to the truth that the flow of the grace of the All-Merciful can never cease, was revealed. And Baha'u'llah here quotes again from the Quran. He says, and Joseph came to you aforetime with clear tokens, but ye ceased not to doubt of the message with which he came to you, until when he died ye said, God will by no means raise up a messenger after him. Thus God misleadeth him who is the transgressor, the doubter. That's the end of the quote from the Quran. Baha'u'llah goes on, he says, therefore, understand from this verse and know of a certainty that the people in every age, clinging to a verse of the book, have uttered such vain and absurd sayings, contending that no prophet should again be made manifest to the world. Even as the Christian divines who, holding fast to a verse of the gospel, to which we have already referred, have sought to explain that the law of the gospel should at no time be annulled, and that no independent prophet shall again be made manifest unless he confirmeth the law of the gospel. Then Baha'u'llah adds this significant statement. He says, most of the people have become afflicted with the same spiritual disease. Now we see this, people tend to think, you know, that, well, you can't have a prophet again, or I have my own religion, why do I need another one? And yet all the prophets have talked about their own return or the return of another great one after them. And all of these followers of these religions believe, according to their teachings, should believe that more messengers will come, that more teachings are to come. But by certain interpretations and holding of certain verses, as the phrase seal of the prophets in the Quran that was mentioned, they say, okay, this means the book is closed now. This is the greatest book. The Quran is the last book. Or the Christians say that there'll never be anything after the Bible because this is the true word of God. And if you turn onto anything else, you're going to go to hell. And so these things became veils to mankind. When the Bab and Baha'u'llah appeared, very few people turned to them because of first the veils of the clergy themselves, who told them, look at these verses and see what he's saying, this is not the same, and they became the means of the people not recognizing the new religion. Now we see what's happened in 100 years since then. Baha'u'llah has loosened the ties of religion. You know, through the rejection of the people of the new day, of the revelation of the Bab and Baha'u'llah, irreligion began to sweep the face of the world, until even political movements like communism became replacement religions. And the kind of sway that was held, that I don't think we can even understand. Maybe some of the Persians who were living in Iran and know how the fanatic people feel about their religion, they understand some of this. But in the West, we don't understand it. Maybe if you've known Catholics in the United States and Canada, they sometimes are very fervent. Then if you've known Protestants in Latin America, because the Catholics were always in Latin America, then the Protestants came, and a few of those people that changed, that left the Catholic Church because they really had conviction of some sort, even if it was misguided, they became very stirred up and excited. But most of the other people have just kind of let religion go. And if they haven't let it go in form, if they still are born and baptized and married and buried in the church, they at least they're not thinking of it as having a major role in dictating to them how they should act, how they should believe. And it's not the source of their attaining to the presence of God and communing with the Spirit of God daily as a part of their whole the makeup of their lives. There are exceptions to this, of course, every place. But in general, we see this as the tendency of mankind. So now, the message has a different sound in people's hearts. They don't know the old prophecies very well. Most of them don't know what the Bible says. Most of them don't know what the Quran says. So you start fresh with them, with the message of Baha'u'llah, and now we're beginning to see entry by troops. Do you have any questions or comments on what we've been reading up to now? Does anyone want to say anything? We go on reading a little more here. Even as thou dost witness how the people of the Quran, like unto the people of old, have allowed the word seal of the prophets to veil their eyes. And yet they themselves testify to this verse. None knoweth the interpretation thereof but God, and they that are well grounded in knowledge. And when he who is well grounded in all knowledge, he who is the mother, the soul, the secret, and the essence thereof, revealeth that which is the least contrary to their desire, they bitterly oppose him and shamelessly deny him. These thou hast already heard and witnessed. Such deeds and words have been solely instigated by leaders of religion, they that worship no god but their own desire, who bear allegiance to naught but gold, who are wrapped in the densest veils of learning, and who, enmeshed by its obscurities, are lost in the wilds of error. This is Baha'u'llah's description of clergy, of the divines. of the priests. Look how he characterizes them. They worship no god but their own desire. Qualification number one that he gives there. My goodness. Then he says, they bear allegiance to nothing but gold. Now, Baha'u'llah has also said this in another tablet. He said, Shi'ism has been converted into commercialism. Even in his lifetime, he said, they are all interested in commerce. They are not uplifting and regenerating the souls of people. They're trading and they're making money and making their positions powerful. And then he says, they're wrapped in the densest veils of learning. And the obscurities of this learning, which they pride themselves on, how they have memorized thousands of hadiths, thousands of these traditional sayings, or they have studied the books of the interpreters of the Quran and are able to recite them and repeat them and so on. Because of all this, he says, they're lost in the wilds of error. And you see this, you see the valley of bereavement, the wilds of error, the deserts of remoteness. There's a spiritual geography that you find in the holy texts where you can read about it. It's got clouds and heavens and oceans and deserts and wilds and wildernesses and very, very terrifying places and very, very wonderful places. It has gardens, it has soft flowing waters, it has everything. It's spiritual geography. Somebody should prepare a course or a class on spiritual geography to teach us, show us the maps of the spiritual worlds. Even as the Lord of Being hath explicitly declared, what thinkest thou? He who hath made a god of his passions, and whom God caused to err through a knowledge, and whose ears and whose heart he hath sealed up, and over whose sight he hath cast a veil, who, after his rejection by God, shall guide such a one? Will ye not then be warned? That's a very interesting verse. Again from the Quran. He who hath made a god of his passions, and whom God caused to err through a knowledge. Now Baha'u'llah goes on to explain some of the meaning of this erred through a knowledge. He says, although the outward meaning of whom God causeth to err through a knowledge is what has been revealed, in the sense here that because, I think he means here, because that person has made a god of his passions, yet to us it signifieth those divines of the age who have turned away from the beauty of God, and who, clinging unto their own learning, as fashioned by their own fancies and desires, have denounced God's divine message and revelation. Then he quotes from the Quran again to make his point. Say, it is a weighty message from which ye turn aside. Because Muhammad had to say this to the deniers in his time. Same verses are being repeated, the same thoughts. Baha'u'llah is showing how this pattern repeats itself. Muhammad, when he revealed himself, everyone said, who is this man? Why? He's just compiled the old things of the ancients and he says it's a new book. People were all shy to follow him and they didn't know what to do. That was the beginning of his mission. Also with the Bab, the same kind of reaction. In very short, it became very dangerous to follow the new messenger of God. You really had to be convinced before you were going to put your foot forward because it was going to be chopped off or something terrible was going to happen. You wanted to know that you really believed. And this was the way God sifted, in a sense, between those who were sincere and those who weren't. Think he will say, I believe, and not be put to test? There were heavy tests. And those early friends of Muhammad also suffered vilification and they were pelted with stones and cursed by the whole population all the time. Life was a misery. Why? Simply because they said, I believe that what he says is true. Likewise, he saith, and when our clear verses are recited unto them, they say, this is merely a man who would fain pervert you from your father's worship and they say, this is none other than a forged falsehood. Then Baha'u'llah goes on to say, give ear unto God's holy voice, and heed thou his sweet and immortal melody. Behold how he hath solemnly warned them that have repudiated the verses of God, and hath disowned them that have denied his holy words. Consider how far the people have strayed from the Kothar of the Divine Presence, and how grievous hath been the faithlessness and arrogance of the spiritually destitute in the face of that sanctified beauty. Although that essence of loving kindness and bounty caused those evanescent beings to step into the realm of immortality and guided those destitute souls to the sacred river of wealth, yet some denounced him as a calumniator of God, the Lord of all creatures. Others accused him of being the one that withholds the people from the path of faith and true belief. And still others declared him to be a lunatic and the like. Now imagine if you were in the spiritual world and looking down on this scene, and you knew the power of the manifestation of God to be all-encompassing, that in an instant he could take the life of the souls, he could wipe them all out, he could make a fire over them all, he could send them all to the ocean. He could do anything he wanted, really. He doesn't, but he could. And because you're in a realm that's higher than this, you have seen and recognized the majesty and greatness of the manifestation of God, and then you witness that God sends one of these messengers down to the world. And you watch with anxiety and interest to see if this great holy being, what will be the response of those around him? And as he moves and as he speaks, you see the people say, he's crazy, or they throw stones at him, or worse, they kill him. Then we would see this, if we could understand what the drama is for the manifestation of God, who sees the people. He knows he is the source of the whole, their salvation, their happiness, their joy, their fulfillment in life. And then he sees this whole scene of rejection. Now we say, how can they say they suffer so much? Some people say, well, why do you say the prophets suffer so much? I mean, lots of people suffer. People are hungry, they get in car accidents, all kinds of things happen to them. But why is you say he suffers so much? Because it's this whole question of what they know and the lost opportunities that they witness in all of us. Because of the capacities that they've placed in us, they see we don't use that capacity, we don't act on that possibility that we have in us to respond with the fullness of our being, with the full force of the love and joy of our hearts to what the manifestation calls us to. Now, we're fortunate. Look, now we say we're Baha'is. But of course, the same thing is applying to us now. To what degree are we Baha'is? They wrote the Guardian, one of the friends wrote the Guardian and said, I don't know what we're going to do with these Baha'is, Shoghi Effendi. I'm so depressed with the Baha'is. I mean, this kind of letters would come sometimes. As the believers get discouraged with each other. Now, the best remedy for that is to look at the mote in your own eye, of course, as Christ says. You know, just check out your own shortcomings, and that should keep you busy enough to not notice everybody else has them. No one said anybody was perfect in this life. We're all imperfect. In fact, that's a divine principle. We're all imperfect. So you are fulfilling one of the divine commandments if you're not perfect. That doesn't mean we're not supposed to try to be something else and by degrees move away from our shortcomings. But at least we shouldn't get too upset if the other people are fulfilling this divine truth in their lives. Now, he asked Shoghi Effendi about this. Shoghi Effendi says, that this is just the beginning, he said. The Baha'is of the future will be 100 times better Baha'is. 100 times, imagine. I wonder now, sometimes I think about myself as 100 times, well, I don't know. That's still going to be good enough for Baha'u'llah, but it's a start. Maybe after 200 years, after 300 years, after 500 years, they will really begin to have grown within an environment, within a society that will allow them to blossom to full and use all these capacities and talents that God will endow them with. Our problem now is we're surrounded by a civilization that doesn't give a hoot about spirituality, or it doesn't seem to give a hoot. Now we see that if we really dedicate ourselves to the teaching work and to trying to raise the call of Baha'u'llah among the people, and we beg his assistance, then he casts a veil over the people's eyes so they don't see what we're really like, and he lets us teach his faith. You know? He says, cover the sins of others as I cover your sins. What is that? Something to remember. You unveil the sins of the others, maybe he'll unveil our sins. We don't want to do that. We should be thinking in terms of teaching the people, trusting that his power, his grace, will help to cut through these veils that they have. And these veils are these same doubts that the people have had over the years. They don't hear enough. Now you can say to yourself, well, they would believe, if I were a better Baha'i, they would believe these books to be true. But what about the case of the manifestation of God? Himself is speaking to them and they're saying, no, 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 you're not the one. That's a no way out kind of situation. They have really shut the door on the grace of God. He goes on to describe this some more. He says, in like manner, thou observest in this day with what vile imputations they have assailed that gem of immortality. And you remember the descriptions of Shoghi Effendi of the Bab as being meek, gentle, this radiant youth, meek and gentle. And they're saying the worst things they can about it. What unspeakable transgressions they have heaped upon him who is the source of purity. Although God hath throughout his book and in his holy and immortal tablet warned them that deny and repudiate the revealed verses, and hath announced his grace unto them that accept them, yet behold the unnumbered cavils they raised against those verses which have been sent down from the new heaven of God's eternal holiness. This notwithstanding the fact that no eye hath beheld so great an outpouring of bounty. Now he begins to tell us something. This is Baha'u'llah now characterizing the writings of the Bab, the revelation of the Bab, the verses sent forth from the primal point. You know what the primal point, you think of this primal point? This title of the Bab comes from a verse, from a tradition also, of Muhammad, where he says, actually it's a there are various versions of it. The one that I recall is the one from Ali, from the Imam Ali. He talks about Bismillah al-Rahman al-Rahim. This is an Arabic verse that opens the Quran. Bismillah means in the name of God, Rahman al-Rahim, the merciful, the compassionate. The beginning of the book of God, the first word, begins with the letter B. Now he says that the spirit and essence of the whole of the Quran is in this first verse, is in the first surah, he says first, and then he says that's the first chapter. And then he says that the essence of the first chapter is in the first verse, the essence of the first verse is in the first word, Bismillah, which is three words in English but one word in Arabic, in the name of God. And then he says that the essence of that word is in the first letter. And then he says the essence of that letter is in the point. Now, the letter B in Arabic is written like this. It has a little stand there, and then it comes along like that, and there's a point under it. If you put 2 points under it, it's a Y. If you put 2 points over it, it's a T. But put 1 point under it, it's a B. If you put 1 point over it, it's an N. Those are the way the letters go. But in this case, there's 1 point under it, it's a B. So he says, this is the essence of everything is in that point, that B, which is a single point. Then Ali goes on and he says, I am that point. I am that point. Extraordinary statement. Now, This point is also associated in the traditions and in the teachings of the Imams with the point of the pen. You know that one of the titles of the manifestation of God is the Supreme Pen. And with this pen, God writes whatever he wants to write. He writes two books, actually. He writes the book of creation and he writes the book of revelation. And Abdu'l-Bahá says that the book of creation is filled up with chapters. I mean, you know, you've got galaxies and solar systems and planets and creatures and everything. It's got all these different stages, the same as the book of God. It has its major sections and its chapters and its verses and its words and its points and its letters. And these two books are in complete accord one with another. The study of either one will reveal to you the meanings of the other. The book of nature will reveal the meanings of the book of God. That's why we have all these examples in here of heavens and skies and suns and rivers and oceans and all these things. We need an outer world to symbolize to us, to suggest what the meaning of the divine verses are. On the other hand, the divine verses tell us what the significance of these natural phenomena are, how from them we can draw understanding of our relationship with God, and so on. So he says, I am this point. Now when the Bab comes and he says that I'm the primal point generated by God, this is not a small thing, because for centuries this has been associated with Ali. You see? This has been associated with the Imams, with the great ones of the past of their faith. The Bab is a title, a similar title. After the 12 Imams, after 11 Imams really, the 12th Imam was the hidden Imam. He didn't show himself, but he spoke through four representatives, successive representatives. And these successive representatives were each called a Bab. There were four Babs. Now they were the Bab, the door to the hidden Imam. Now when Ali Muhammad, the Bab, announced that he was the Bab, they thought he's the fifth door. Then later he explained that he was the Babullah, not the Bab of the hidden Imam, but the gate of God himself. And then he said, Mullah Hussein was the Babul Bab, the gate of that gate of God. So this was also very challenging. And we think of these titles and we think, oh, that's interesting. He took the name Gate or Bob. But it doesn't shake our whole beings, you know, and say, well, how dare he's claiming to be this? Is it true or isn't it true? I mean, immediately you'd have to solve this problem. Is this true or isn't it true? This is why Shoghi Effendi says we should look into the circumstances of Islam and the circumstances surrounding society at the time that the Bab declared his mission. That will give us a deep appreciation of what kind of an impact his words had when he said, I am the primal point, I am the Bab. How this shook the whole country. A merchant who hasn't even been to the school of the divines, has studied none of the holy books, as far as they know, is saying he's going to be the gate of God. Right off, they didn't like the sound of that. You know, they would be against this right away. Now, Baha'u'llah, in revealing the extent of the verses of the Bab, says, he refers to how they've been warned, those that deny and repudiate the verses. And he hath announced, says, hath announced his grace unto them that accept them. Yet behold the unnumbered cavils they raised against those verses which have been sent down from the new heaven of God's eternal holiness. This notwithstanding the fact that no eye hath beheld so great an outpouring of bounty, nor hath any ear heard of such a revelation of loving kindness. Such bounty and revelation hath been made manifest that the revealed verses seemed as vernal showers. Do you know what vernal means? Everybody knows what vernal means? Vernal? Summer. If you know Spanish, verano comes from Latin, vernal. It means summer showers. Raining from the clouds of the mercy of the All-Bountiful. The prophets endowed with constancy, whose loftiness and glory shine as the sun, were each honored with a book which all have seen and the verses of which have been duly ascertained. Whereas the verses which have rained from this cloud of divine mercy have been so abundant that none hath yet been able to estimate their number. Available. How many still remain beyond our reach? A score is 20, isn't it? How many still remain beyond our reach? How many have been plundered and have fallen into the hands of the enemy, the fate of which none knoweth? Do you remember in the Dawn Breakers there's an estimate of the number of verses revealed by the Bab? Do you remember how many that was? 15,000? Anybody else remember anything? That's right, but it's more than that. How many? 20? How many verses did he say? Does anyone remember? Okay, it's 500,000. 500,000 verses. Now, has there ever been a revelation like that? Along comes the Bab and he reveals more than all of the prophets of history have revealed all together. And they say, imposter, he's made a compilation of the past. Now, it's pretty fancy compiling, I must say that. Now, you see, he says also, he quotes, Baha'u'llah quotes this hadith, that knowledge is 27 letters. And he says, all that the prophets of the past revealed were two letters. And now the promised Qayyim has come and revealed the other 25. So if knowledge is, if you think symbolically of knowledge as being something of 27 units, the prophets of the past brought two of those units. And the Bab, the other 25. And then the Bab politely offers to our understanding, he says, that to read one verse of Him whom God shall make manifest is greater than reading the entire revelation of my verses. One verse. So you see again what a jump in magnitude, the intensity with which God hath endowed the verses revealed by Baha'u'llah. You can look at a list of the writings, the best known writings of the Bab in any one of the Baha'i World books. In a section under bibliography, you'll find a list of the best-known writings of Baha'u'llah, of the Bab, and of Abdu'l-Bahá. And I recommend you look at that list and you say, how many of these have I read? You'll look down there. First of all, you can't even figure out what they are because they're in Arabic and Persian. Unless you read Arabic and Persian, then you'll know. But you'll say, look at these. Some of them haven't even been published yet. They're there. They're known in the East. They're passed around, copied in manuscript form, and so on. There's a comparison given, which we already referred to earlier in the course, but I'll read it again for you. It's very interesting. There are a number of references in the writings to the rapidity with which the Bab and Baha'u'llah revealed the divine verses. Well, you can imagine they couldn't waste time. If Bob was going to reveal, he had a 6-year ministry and he was revealing at least 500,000 verses, he had to be revealing a lot of the time. And people had to be trying to take it down, or he had to be writing it down himself, or he had to be writing it down while he was also revealing something to somebody else. This is the way that also the master did. He would recite a tablet for someone else to write down, or 2 or 3 tablets, have different secretaries taking them down and give one verse to one verse to another, one verse to another, and then back second verse. And at the same time, he was penning on tablet himself to somebody else while he was dictating these tablets, keeping them busy. He was busy himself, didn't waste any time. And now when he says he did, 90 tablets in a night, you understand how he was able to do that. I think it's a good talent. It should be passed along to the members of the House of Justice and other struggle 3 days with one letter or something, trying to get a get a draft right and submit it to the House. Yeah. So there are a number of references in the Baha'i writings to the rapidity with which the Bab and Baha'u'llah revealed the divine verses. A certain Muhammad Karim, a native of Shiraz, who had been a witness to the rapidity and the manner in which the Bab had penned the verses with which he was inspired, has left the following testimony to posterity after attaining during those days the presence of Baha'u'llah and beholding with his own eyes what he himself had considered to be the only proof of the mission of the Promised One. I guess you would feel that way. If you had been in the presence of the Bab and seen him revealing these divine verses and felt the impact of that power, you would want to witness anyone else that claimed to be in a similar position to see if they had this same power and intensity and majesty of revelation. So that was his proof, was to come and see Baha'u'llah. This is his testimony. He says, "I bear witness that the verses revealed by Baha'u'llah were superior in the rapidity with which they were penned, in the ease with which they flowed, in their lucidity, their profundity and sweetness, to those which I myself saw pour from the pen of the Bab when in his presence. Had Baha'u'llah no other claim to greatness, this were sufficient in the eyes of the world and its people, that he produced such verses as have streamed this day from his pen." You'll find that in God Passes By, page 138. There's testimony of how they couldn't write these verses down. It's like a torrent pouring out of Baha'u'llah. Even Mirza Agha Jan says that oftentimes when Baha'u'llah was revealing, he could write down only 1 in 5 verses. Those others would get lost along the way. Then Baha'u'llah afterwards would take time with him, because this was the moment of revelation. Afterwards he would recite for him and correct the tablets, sit and correct them, add in things that he'd missed. Then he said after a while you would fall into a swoon trying to copy down Baha'u'llah's words as he was revealing. And then only those that seemed to be endowed with the capacity, could even begin to decipher any of the words that he was saying. Most of the testimonies about people who were in Baha'u'llah's presence, and that wasn't often because he sent them away out of consideration, It was so overwhelming to be there as he started walking and reciting these original verses straight from the heavens of divine revelation. It would shake the people. And they couldn't move and they couldn't think, and afterwards they would say, "Well, I don't know. All I heard was thunder. I couldn't hear words. I just... thunder." Now we read the words and we fall asleep. That includes me. It's another generation. We're trying.
I have a question concerning the four Bab. What is their station in comparison to the Imam?
They're affirmed as having been mouthpieces, so to speak, of the 12th Imam, but they certainly don't have the rank of the Imams. They're a secondary figure in that sense, as far as I know. I've never heard anybody speak about their station as being a station, but
so they are in the lower rank.
Yes, they were like a spokesman.
Would you accept
that? The four? Yes, I think so. We'd have to see. I'd have to check. I don't know. Do you know anything about that, Mark? The Sina affirmation? I'm sure it's affirmed someplace. It's part of the Shia tradition. They know the names of them and everything. I don't know why we wouldn't.
This is important. This period of time after the Imams were gone, I can't remember what it was called, what we call it.
The Lesser Occultation was the name of it. Yes, this is referred to in the writings, the Lesser and Greater Occultation. occultation meaning the hiding of the light of truth, so to speak. So you had the imams, 11 imams, and then the lesser occultation began at the time of the 12th imam, who spoke to the four representatives. And the last representative didn't appoint another one, and no one knew where the imam was, and they said he was alive and went into some hidden cities under the ground, and he'll come out in the time of the end. That's also they expected that the Qayyim would actually come out of his hiding place in the hidden cities and arise and proclaim himself. So when they found out he's born in Shiraz and raised there, that also was a test to the people. You know? And then the major occultation is after those four were gone, then they didn't have any connection. There's no way they could ask that had this divine authority by transmission for a full 1,000 years. It's 1260, the end of the last imam. And then there were 1,000 years, that was not 1260, but what is it? 260 of the Muslim era. That lasted 260 years, the imamate, which is the name for the whole 12 of them. And then 1,000 years until the Bab appeared. Now, things got pretty grim in the middle, to such a degree that God inspired Rumi to write his marvelous Masnavi, a book which made the Orientals to say that some prophets don't have a book, and there are some books that don't have a prophet. And this was like a book of God that wasn't revealed by a prophet, it was revealed by a poet, by a mystic. And I've only heard verbally, but I've heard that the master said that if Rumi hadn't appeared in the middle to prop up the tent of existence, that we wouldn't have made it through to the Bab. It was getting so low. But his spiritual teachings infused a new life into Islam at that time. It's a very important station. And as a poet, he was inspired. So we have Baha'u'llah on picnics and on different occasions asking the believers to chant the Masnavi of Rumi. Rumi was his name, Maulana Rumi. And they would be chanted in the picnics and things in his presence. And even the believers would ask the meaning of some of the verses of the poetry of Rumi. And we have samples from Baha'u'llah, I think from Baha'u'llah, I know from Abdul Baha, but I've also heard from Baha'u'llah, explaining what are the spiritual inner meanings of the verses of the poetry of Rumi. And then we move on. 1260, we have the appearance of the Bab. Oh brother, Baha'u'llah says, we should open our eyes, meditate upon his word, and seek the sheltering shadow of the manifestations of God, that perchance we may be warned by the unmistakable counsels of the book, and give heed to the admonitions recorded in the holy tablets, that we may not cavil at the revealer of the verses, that we may resign ourselves wholly to his cause and embrace wholeheartedly his law, that haply we may enter the court of his mercy and dwell upon the shore of his grace. He verily is merciful and forgiving towards his servants. This last verse is, though it's not in quotation marks, it's taken from the surah of the table, the fifth surah of the Quran. It's exact, checked it in the two books, in the Arabic, and it's the same. It wasn't the custom in the East to put quotation marks. When constantly it was a part of the literary culture to quote things, interweave phrases and sayings and from the holy books and from famous poets and authors all together. And then it was for you to decipher where those things had come from. So that most of them have been identified in the Quran with quotation marks, but not always. And some of the things that are identified with quotation marks are actually Baha'u'llah revealing in Arabic in the Persian Qur'an, according to what they've been able to discover. And likewise he said, say, O people of the book, Do ye not disavow us only because we believe in God and in what he hath sent down to us and in what he hath sent down aforetime, and because most of you are doers of ill? How explicitly doth this verse reveal our purpose, and how clearly it demonstrates the truth of the testimony of the verses of God. This verse was revealed at a time when Islam was assailed by the infidels, and its followers were accused of mischief, when the companions of Muhammad were denounced as repudiators of God and as followers of a lying sorcerer. In its early days, when Islam was still to outward seeming devoid of authority and power, the friends of the Prophet who had turned their face toward God, wherever they went, were harassed, persecuted, stoned, and vilified. At such a time, this blessed verse was sent down from the heaven of divine revelation. It revealed an irrefutable evidence and brought the light of an unfailing guidance. It instructed the companions of Muhammad to declare the following unto the infidels and idolaters: Ye oppress and persecute us, and yet what else have we done except that we have believed in God and in the verses sent down unto us through the tongue of Muhammad and in those which descended upon the prophets of old? By this is meant that their only guilt of these early followers was to have recognized that the new and wondrous verses of God which had descended upon Muhammad, as well as those which had been revealed unto the prophets of old, were all of God, and to have acknowledged and embraced their truth. This is the testimony which the Divine King hath taught his servants. In view of this, is it fair for this people to repudiate these newly revealed verses which have encompassed both the East and the West, and to regard themselves as the upholders of true belief? Should they not rather believe in him who hath revealed these verses? Considering the testimony which he himself hath established, how could he fail to account as true believers them that have testified to its truth? Far be it from him that he should turn away from the gates of his mercy them that have turned unto and embraced the truth of the divine verses, or that he should threaten those that have clung to his sure testimony. He verily establisheth the truth through his verses, and confirmeth his revelation by his words. He verily is the powerful, the help in peril, the almighty. Now, perhaps you'll recall in one of the tablets of Baha'u'llah, he speaks about the proofs of manifestations, and he says that the greatest proof of the manifestation is his own person, his own self. This is the first proof. The second proof, he says, is the revelation. And the third proof is the words and meanings of the verses. Now, we would say, well, what's the difference between the words and meanings of the verses and revelation? But my understanding of this is that his first proof is just his own person. If you could meet him, come into his presence, that would be sufficient proof. After that, he says, is that when he reveals verses, the power that he has of revelation, the power to reveal divine verses, apart from whatever the verses say, that ability to reveal these verses that are in cadence and poetic forms and rhythmic in their character, that if you wanted to try to compose one, you couldn't. Even if you studied this style for a long time, he says, produce one verse like this, Muhammad says in the Quran. Can you produce one? Produce a surah, a chapter, if you speak truth. And nobody could ever copy that. Singular in its essence. And the quality of the Bab's writings and Baha'u'llah's writings is the same quality of the verses, quite distinct from anything else that you could find in the language, and still distinct from Muhammad's verses. And the Bab's and Baha'u'llah's verses are distinguishable in the originals. The friends that study them tell us. So we have what? First, his person. Second, to witness his revelation itself. And third, the meanings of these verses, which he says here, he established his truth through his verses and confirmed his revelation by his words. He verily is the powerful, the help in peril, the almighty. Now I want to get over to the next page because from there on we have another subject. He brings out the from Revelation proofs relating to the person of the Bab and his dispensation, his revelation. And we'll finish one more paragraph here. And likewise he saith, and had we sent down unto thee a book written on parchment, and they had touched it with their hands, the infidels would surely have said, this is not but palpable sorcery. First they say, give us a proof. The prophet sends a book out of the sky, a parchment book, the manifestation says, here it is, touch it. They touch it, they say, this is magic, you fooled us. What do you want, you know? Anything you give them, they don't want. Then they say, no, this is false. Now we're really afraid. They were afraid of Baha'is to drink tea in the meetings of the Baha'is. They said, the Baha'is have a tea that changes your soul. If we had a tea, wouldn't that be marvelous? If we had a tea that could change soul? It's harder than that. I remember hearing this story from one of the Persian youth that came to South America. He said that the Muslims were bothering them and saying, you know, but, oh yeah, what did the Bab ever do? He says, you know, Muhammad, he took his sword and he split the moon in two. Now, what do you say to that? He said, who do you think put it back together again? About this equal weight of argument. It's not split still. I mean, something must have happened. Most of the verses of the Quran are indicative of this theme. We have, for the sake of brevity, mentioned only these verses. Consider, hath anything else besides the verses been established in the whole book as a standard for the recognition of the manifestations of His beauty, that the people might cling to and reject the manifestations of God? On the contrary, in every instance, He hath threatened with fire those that repudiate and scoff at the verses, as already shown. But we'll use this as an introduction to the next time, and then we'll move on. We'll be on page 221, 220, 221 next time if you want to read ahead. Okay, thank you. Someone kindly offered to bring refreshments, but I don't know whether they came this time or not. Is there some? It's okay. Please. This is what some of the friends say. Of course, he didn't just disappear in the ground. Shoghi Effendi has also said the 12th Imam died. I mean, obviously, he's also a man, and he died. But he wasn't in touch with the people personally. They didn't know. They knew stories from these four gates. But it's no wonder, you know, because they were killing all the Imams always anyway. I mean, it's not that he's just hiding for to make it interesting or something. I mean, it was really... I don't have that in my head, but it can be found in the Kitab al-Irshad, which I think is... Be careful if you go to the library once in a while, but not everybody go to look for this book, or they'll ask what the class is. I tell them, I don't tell my class to go to the library here to look for things. If you appoint a representative and one of you go and find out... I also have the book. I remember where you can find it, I can tell you. But the dates of the lives of the Imams are all there. In fact, I think they're even in the introduction to the Dawnbreakers. And they're certainly in Mujan Momen's book on Shia Islam. Now, is anybody interested in offering refreshments next week? We need somebody. I don't know who's in charge of that. I can say... Cici will organize it. If anyone else wants to collaborate, you can speak to Cici. Okay. Here we have a second part to offer. All right. Okay, thank you.